From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 36th installment of our conversation ongoing with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR and the constellation of events around that. And thank you for your time today, Luciana.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we're going to be looking, finishing up the myths of Stalin, right?
Yeah, we're in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And I have a little preamble, if you like.
Please do.
Okay, so we are, excuse me, we're talking about the falsification of history, about the Soviet Union by the West, anti-Soviet propaganda. That was the topic we began last time. Now, falsification is called politely revisionism. And anti-Soviet revisionists, however, don't revise history in the sense of, you know, correcting it. They rewrite it in the shape of really bold lies or untenable apologies. In some cases, they face whole histories. So, for example, the United States have effaced the memory of the Second World War and the resistance of the Soviet people. Western imaginary, we see this war turn around the question, around the Jewish question, is we liberated, the United States liberated the Jews. If you ask American, that's the answer. Oh, yeah, we liberated the Jews. Forgetting that the colonial ideology, which required Lebensraum, which was the German extension, Lebensraum means room, living room. Room to live in,
right.
Which was the German extension east, and actually included the programmed genocide of all the Slav populations. That's not just the Russians. Slavs were inferior people.
Right.
So that's one example, and I don't want to give more. This revisionism, I think, took off. Well, intensely, 1969, with the publication in English of the Great Terror by Robert Conquest, followed by Solzhenitsyn. It surfaced in Germany with the historian Ernst Nolte. It is alive in France since 2005. And we'll talk about that, okay, in later programs.
Yes.
The history of revisionism sweeping all of Europe. And that is really amounting to the equation that Nazism and Sovietism are totalitarian and are equal, morally equal, criminally equal, etc. So, for today. So last week we identified and proposed to examine eight major old Western myths about the Soviet Union. And I'll repeat them. Number one, the collectivization of agriculture was a brutal repression of the peasantry. Number two, that this collectivization caused the famine of 1932-33 and was intended to crush Ukraine's independence from Soviet domination. Number three, that the Great Terror, or Yezovshchina, killed 690,000 people. Number four, that the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was an alliance between Hitler and Stalin. Number five, that the Soviet Union invaded Poland in September 1939. Number six, that the Katyn massacre of 6,000 Polish officers was carried out by the Soviets. Number seven, that the Warsaw Uprising was a heroic event of Polish nationalism instead of a wanton disaster by anti-Soviet Polish forces. Number 8, that Stalin was anti-Semitic.
Right.
So we discussed 1 and 2 and suggested that the collectivization of agriculture is to be considered a reform. And then we discussed and debunked, tried to debunk the myths of the Holodomor. And I'm not going to go into this now. So, but we only touched upon the Great Terror. So these would be the years 1936-39, the years of the Moscow trial, of the three major Moscow trials. So today, I would like to dwell on these trials and on two witnesses of the trials who were not sympathetic to communism, but who nevertheless noted that the trials were not staged, as it is maintained in the West, show trials they're called, that they were not staged to secure the bureaucratic absolutism of Stalin. These two, and before I get to them, I add that today even the most serious anti-communist historians recognize that the figure of the victims of Stalin's purges have been swollen out of proportion, and in fact that the total of people arrested for political reasons and executed from 1921 to 1953 amount to 700,000, which is a considerable amount, but we had to remember the situation in the Soviet Union, the Civil War, and what of the 1920, 21, and several others. So 700,000 as opposed to the 30 million that Conquest said, that I can't remember what million that Timothy Snyder said, and the responsible charges of 100 million that also surfaced. So,
right. Which were so ridiculous. I mean, the population of the USSR was less than 200 million, so you would have seen just like every other man, woman, and or child would have disappeared if they killed 100 million
people. I have somewhere the figures from 1928. There were 147 million people in the Soviet Union, and in 1938, there were 168 million people. These are low figures.
Right.
168, and that the Russian population growth rate was well above that of Western Europe. I can't remember the percentage, 1.42. The highest in Western, compared to Western Europe, except for Italy, amazingly. So, yeah, I mean, the population actually grew.
Right.
So if we, you know...
Where did those 100 million people go?
I don't know. I don't know. They went into ink.
No, it's supposed to be like the, what is it? The rapture. They just disappeared.
They just went
to heaven.
But, so the figure of 700,000 that I just got, that I just gave, is really based on one post-Soviet historian named Zhezkov, Zhezkov and who else? And endorsed by a collaborator of Stephen Cohen, the American historian that wrote the biography of Bukharin. Stephen Cohen is often, you remember him, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Stephen Cohen is an American historian who is much valued among liberal circles because he doesn't demonize Russia, but he nevertheless supported Gorbachev and believed that the Soviet government was an absolutist organ.
Right. Totalitarian.
Yeah. And he collaborated with a very interesting historian named Moshe. It's L-O-E-W-N, in something, but it's pronounced Levine. Moshe Levine. He confirms that this 700,000 people arrested for political reasons and executed is a correct correct number. We can, you know, Moshe Levin is a very interesting person, historian. He was born in Russia. He enlisted in the Red Army. He was Polish. He enlisted in the Red Army, then he went to Israel, then he ended up at Columbia, then he ended up at the University of Pennsylvania and died a few years ago, and his papers are stored in the University of Pennsylvania. So he was a communist, or rather a faithful supporter of the Great Patriotic War and fought in it, but nevertheless he was a Bukharinite. And right. and he confirms the Zhezkov number, which comes out of the opening of the Russian archives. So whereas Conquest and Solzhenitsyn and those people wrote before the opening of the archives, this number investigated the KGB files and the juridical files. Okay, is that clear? I didn't mean
yes.
to go into that.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
So in spite
yeah.
of everything, in fact that there are these important historians in the background, not necessarily communist historians, the myth of the terror under the personal dictatorship of Stalin persists, and never for a moment does it admit that perhaps those condemned in the Moscow trials were really guilty. This is never considered. But we have two witnesses who do admit it and are never mentioned, and they are very important. The first is Joseph Davis.
Right.
He was ambassador of the United States to Moscow during the Moscow trial, and the second one is a British jurist named Pritt, to whom I will... referred to later.
Yeah, we're talking. Now, Pritt is Dennis Noel Pritt, and he wrote the rather extensive piece of work about it called "At the Moscow Trial."
I'm not familiar with that. What? Yeah, repeat that, please.
Printed in 1937. It's called "At the Moscow Trial." It's he's listed in the customary way in the Soviet Union by D.N. Pritt, but it's actually he's a Brit, and his name is he was a British jurist. It's Dennis Noel Pritt.
Oh, Dennis! No, I thought you said no. Oh, I thought it was somebody else. Fine.
That's him. Yep.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to have to. I would like to quote from Davis's testimony extensively. Just right. feel free to jump in, okay, when you know, to add and stuff. Right. Now, Davis, who was appointed, I suppose, by FDR, because he was in Moscow in 1937, earlier
right.
too. But anyway, Davis followed, as all the diplomats in Moscow could do and did, he followed the Moscow trials as an observer, and he too was a jurist. So on March 17, 1938, this is the last trial, the trial of Bukharin, he sent his impression to Washington on the trial of Bukharin and others with Bukharin in Moscow. So the dispatch says, in extracts, because this was published in a book in 1943 by Davis. Anyway, extracts. He writes, "Despite my prejudices, after observing the witnesses daily and their manner of deposing, I came to the conclusion that the accused actually violated the Soviet law enumerated in the indictment. And the accusation of high treason, and were actually guilty of the accusation of high treason, so the sentences issued against them were justified. The opinion of the diplomats here, who regularly attended the debates, was unanimous. The trial denounced the existence of a political opposition of the highest level. And then I have some more, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting, by the way.
this is 1938.
No, I know. He goes, you know, he's appointed by FDR to go. And by the way, FDR is the one that actually opened relations with the Soviet Union. The United States did the same thing with the USSR that they did with China after the revolution for 20-something years. They refused to refused to recognize the government. And but FDR, you know, brought the country, you know, into reality on that point. And then he sent Davies over. And Davies toured the country. And also, by the way, there was a movie made in the 1940s by Michael Curtiz called Mission to Moscow.
I think I saw it.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
And it may even be on TCM today, this week sometime, because they've been running Michael Curtiz films. But it's called Mission to Moscow, 1943, based on Davies' book that was published in 1941. And it details his entire experience. He takes a boat over to Europe and tours some of the Western the European capitals, and then goes to Moscow, and then stops back talking to people about what he saw, and then he comes back and reports back to Roosevelt. And at the end of all of that, we end up seeing what unfolded in World War II. And we saw the United States help the Soviet Union essentially take out Hitler. And then when that was over, HUAC, the House Committee on Un-American Activities, or actually the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, thought, gee, this is something that should be scrutinized because it says Stalin's repressions, quote-unquote, weren't as we're reporting them. Of course, he went there. These other characters were sitting in committees in Washington. Therefore, this is something that had to be at least repositioned and Davies and anyone around him silenced and or publicly, flogged.
Whoa, not surprising. Well, listen to this.
This is part of the process of doing what you're describing, though, of fouling the historical record.
Yeah. Well, when we discuss the cult of personality, we're going to come back to Davies and to the rather realistic but sympathetic attitude that Stalin had toward FDR, how he visited him when he was sick in Yalta, how he empathized, in fact said something like, Stalin, something like, how can nature punish a man? So, you know, there was, and then he, there was a great deal of, there was a great deal of affection or something for Roosevelt, or at least they could get along. He knew both Truman and Stalin were imperialists, but he could, but Truman was so rude, managerial, pompous, that by comparison, FDR was something else.
Patrician.
But anyway, Stalin never forgot that both were imperialists.
Right.
But one was decent, and the other one was intolerable.
Right.
I'll come back to that, okay?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was even FDR that referred to Truman as that, that petty little Clark. Something along those lines.
Yeah, I call him that haberdasher.
Right.
He really, anyway, so Ambassador Davies then had already witnessed the trial of Radek and others in 1937, so the previous one. So on February 17th of 1937, he had sent a report to the Secretary of State of the United States, and in it he stated, "Objectivity made me conclude," and he says, "reluctantly," this is 37, so it's a little more cautious tone, "that the state really proved the accusations. There is no doubt about the existence of a very serious conspiracy between the leaders, the accused leaders, against the Soviet government. The violations of the law indicated in the indictment have really been committed and are therefore punishable. I have spoken with practically all the members of the diplomatic corps here present, and except perhaps for one exception," he doesn't mention it, "everyone is of the opinion that the debates in the trials have established the actual existence of a secret plan and a conspiracy aimed at eliminating the government." Now, what we also need to realize from these type of testimonies is that the repression was not addressed to the people in general, civilian. We think, oh my God, he picked up anybody from the street and shot them. Stalin did. No, this was aimed at the highest level of both the political and the military institutions.
Right.
It was not a, it's claimed that this was, that Stalin was enforcing the power, his power, and the power of the party. But in fact, it was actually cleaning it out. I don't know how to put it. Anyway, I'll skip that. It was actually directed against the looseness of the party. So I guess in a way, okay, forget it. I got mixed up. So in his diary, March 11th, 1937, Davis, so this is just a few months later, Davis noted this episode. "Another diplomat yesterday made an instructive consideration. We talked about the trial and he said, 'The accused are without a doubt guilty. We have all witnessed the trial. We are unanimous. And here comes the clincher. But for the outside world, on the contrary, the description of the trial are staged.'" And Davis continues, "He knew how this did not respond to the truth, but apparently it was good that the rest of the world did not know it or had this impression." Then another, he actually reports, he talks about Litvinov, the foreign affairs minister, and he talks about Litvinov in July 4th, 1937. He says, Davis talks about numerous arrests and purges on July 4th, 1937, on the orders of Litvinov. And about Litvinov, he reports, "Litvinov stated that thanks to these purges, it is certain that no betrayal in favor of Berlin or Tokyo would be possible. One day the world will understand that what was done was necessary." And so then Davis continues, "They needed to protect their government from the menacing betrayal. Indeed, they have rendered service to the whole world, preserving from the danger of Hitler's Nazis, preserving it from the danger of Hitler's Nazi world domination. The Soviet Union is a strong bastion against the National Socialist danger. A day will come when the whole world will be able to recognize what a great man Stalin was," he says in 1937, July. Now, another, can I go on with these quotations?
Yeah, do. Yeah, no, this is good. Yeah, do. Definitely,
yeah.
Do.
So the description of Davis's conversation with Stalin was contained in the letter of 9 June 1938, a year later, then the Litvinov report, to his daughter. He wrote to his daughter, and it's rich in lessons. He was impressed by Stalin's personality, and he says to his daughter, if you can imagine a totally different character in every sense from what his most ferocious adversaries have come to describe, then you have an image of this man. The situation I see here and his personality are diametrically opposed. So we're getting towards the end, but so after the fascist aggression of the Soviet Union in June 1941, Davis summarized his view in 1941, saying that, quote, the trials of high treason have routed Hitler's fifth column. So that such names as Bukharin and Trotsky in absence, Zinoviev, Kamenev, they apparently were a fifth column. So we could say that, and Brecht had said this, these were people who had become isolated and had fallen into sabotage and terrorism, and that they saw in the defeat of the USSR a potential for coming to power. Now, this is not necessarily power politics. This could be just that they didn't agree, and Bukharin didn't agree with Stalin since 1928. Trotsky never, but well, this, right. This will be back on this. In 1936, the trials against Zinoviev and others took place. And here, the British lawyer, the one you mentioned, the Pritt, the Pritt lawyer who was a KC, a King's Counsel, wrote his impressions in the book From Right to Left, released in 1965 in London. And he wrote, my impression is that the trial was conducted fairly and that the accused were really guilty. The same feeling is shared by all the journalists with whom I could speak. And certainly all the foreign observers thought, there were many, especially diplomats, thought so. I heard one of them say, this is Pritt, of course they are guilty, but for reasons of propaganda, we have to deny. The journalists and the diplomats, but the journalists too. So it's story yesterday, same as today. The journalists know there was, there's no attack in Duma. They know what that's they're right. writing.
That's right.
So now, in conclusion, if we assume that Davis and Pritt and Brecht, whom I didn't quote, who said the same thing, Wilson, Davis, and Britt were correct in their judgment on the trial of Moscow, and if we assume that they were right, then we must necessarily ask a question. People like Khrushchev and Gorbachev, who declared innocent the victims, the convicts of the Moscow trials, did they not do it because they sympathized with them? Well, certainly we know Gorbachev sympathized with Bukharin tremendously because he had read Stephen Cohen's biography of Gorbachev. We know that. Or were they even accomplices? Now, Gorbachev is too young for that, but Khrushchev certainly can be, that question can be asked of Khrushchev. And so they wanted to put an end to the Soviet Union as it was. And that's my report, shall we say, on people who disagreed that the Moscow trials were staged.
And we got to stop there. So thank you very much, Luciana. We're going to pick it up at this point next week.
Great. Thanks, Don. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York.
Thanks for listening.